spoiled in this sense is to be cursed with an education that flatters its subject into believing in her superiority without making her competitive in the democratic marketplace.
The TIKVA Fund presents The Character and Education of Gwendolyn Harlith, the second episode of an 8-part series on George Eliot's classic novel, Daniel Deronda, led by Professor Ruth Weiss.
This lecture is going to deal with the heroine of this novel. And actually, some people thought that she was so important that the whole book should have been dedicated to her, Gwendolyn Harlith. So we're going to look at her. Interesting personality. On the one hand, she is the new woman. Everything is going for her. She is beautiful. She is fairly talented. And she has a very strong sense of herself. On the other hand, we begin to see that there are things missing in her life. And these things are telling. One, she is not really rooted in the place of her birth or in the traditions from which she derives. She doesn't have any religious background. And so some of the things she experiences are deep terrors, terrors that somehow come over her. And the question is, why? Why would a woman who has so much potential and who is so happy with herself at first, so pleased with herself, what are these terrors? Where are they coming from? And what is going to happen to her going forward? We are going to be talking about Gwendolyn, to which character some of you have been paying close attention for the last while. So on one of her European visits to Hamburg, Germany in 1872, George Eliot visited a gambling casino, and she wrote home to a colleague the following: "There is very little dramatic stuff," meaning material, "to be picked up by watching or listening. The saddest thing to be witnessed is the play of Miss Lay, Byron's grandniece, who is only 26 years old and is completely in the grasp of this mean, money-raking demon. It made me cry to see her young, fresh face among the hags and brutally stupid men around her." So the biographer who quotes this passage, Gordon Haight, remarks that Eliot was obviously mistaken about the scarcity of material, since this scene proved to be the germ of her next model, Daniel Deronda. That's in his reading of it. Well, it's possible that this was a kind of dramatic germ for the opening scene of the novel. But the author, as we can see, turned this girl into something very different from the sad, obsessive gambler that she observed who made her cry. Whatever the sources that encouraged her creation, Gwendolyn is one of the most satisfying, rounded characters in literature, although she is not very admirable, nor to everyone very likable, nor ever deeply satisfied. The unsatisfied part about her is intriguing, because though we know why, she is at various times dejected, miserable, resentful, and troubled, there is some deeper source of disturbance inside her that we can't really account for by the plot alone. And that plot is very eventful. It traces her life in wonderful detail, but it leaves us knowing, I think, that no one could have made her truly happy. So there is some source of anxiety that she tries to keep suppressed. And the novel ties us really intimately to a person whom we are asked to understand through and through, yet for whom we are expected to feel only limited sympathy. Now, I'm not sure that everyone will agree with that, but I think that most people feel it that way, that one may feel sympathy for her, and one is asked to feel sympathy for her quite often by the narrator. But nevertheless, that's not to say that we really do learn to love her completely. So following Gwendolyn through this book requires a kind of intellectual attention that we expect of the psychoanalyst. not surprisingly, at just the time when psychoanalysis was beginning to emerge as a medical option. And it is hardly any wonder that Eliot, who was a brilliant thinker, should have created a case study of this kind that psychoanalysis was soon going to provide. So Gwendolyn has been the subject of some very far-reaching literary psychoanalysis, but we're going to concentrate here mostly on her character and development. So book one does not mince words. It's called The Spoiled Child, and it accounts for certain features in Gwendolyn's imperfect upbringing that helped to form her imperfect character. So first, her mother, Fanny Davalau, rebounded from the death of her first husband, Gwendolyn's father, by marrying a seaman who was something of a scoundrel, but who did not desert her before siring four other daughters. This second marriage brought Mrs. Davalau down in the world, and it burdened her with a sense of having done something wrong. She strongly favors her oldest daughter, and also she feels that she has to make it up to her, for this mistaken second marriage. And Gwendolyn is raised by her mother to feel that by rights she ought to have been an only child. And one day, when they are looking through her father's memorabilia, Gwendolyn says as much. This is the passage. "Why did you marry again, Mama? It would have been nicer if you had not." Mrs. Davalau colored deeply. A slight convulsive movement passed over her face, and straightway, shutting up the memorials, she said with a violence quite unusual in her, "You have no feeling, child." Gwendolyn, who was fond of her mama, felt hurt and ashamed, and had never since dared to ask a question about her father. So some of the repression that is famously associated with Victorian England doesn't allow for frank discussion of sexuality, then or later, and the mother's guilt makes it harder for her to explain to her daughter how life sometimes works between men and women. Now, Gwendolyn obviously does have feelings, but she has far less sympathy for her mother than for herself, and she does not seem to have the kind of sexual drive that impelled her mother to marry the wrong kind of man. And on the whole, it says, and this is come some time later, Mrs. Davalau disliked what is called knowledge of the world. And the text tells us, indeed, she wished that she herself had not had any of it thrust upon her. So there is this very strong idea in the book that sexuality is a problem here. It was a problem of a certain kind for the mother. She got into a marriage which didn't work out for her, presumably on this basis, on the basis of sexual attraction. But the daughter is something else again. And on the whole, Gwendolyn has very keen insight into everything that affects her own needs and wishes, but she has very little interest in other people that could help her understand their needs and wishes. And in a sense, this doesn't develop very much throughout the book. In other words, I think that one can find herself expanding as a person, but I'm not sure that we see her expanding that much in her real understanding of others. And this forms a sharp contrast with Deronda, who thinks more about others than he does about himself. And we might say in the long run, maybe seems to be the happier for it. So in any way, this is one thing, Mrs. Davalau's unhealthy deference to her daughter for the various reasons that are suppressed, repressed, and remain suppressed, even in what the novel chooses to tell us. But this is compounded by the girl's inappropriate education. So Gwendolyn is spoiled in the sense of being indulged without a corresponding sense of responsibility. Gwendolyn has not really been well served by the apparently excellent education that she received. For one thing, it didn't prepare her professionally for anything else. So when she finds herself at the point that she has to earn her own living, she doesn't know what to do. She has no idea what she would be suited for. She has been trained without any sense of responsibility. So although she has a family and she loves her mother and she feels that she probably owes her mother something, this is not a driving idea in her life. And she doesn't want to take that responsibility for anyone else but herself. She discovers that the skills she acquired in the finest finishing schools, they don't allow her to attain her real independence. So what if she proves herself an excellent horsewoman when she joins the men in riding with the hounds? Is she then supposed to become a riding instructor? And so what if she is well-read and she reads and speaks French? This opens up the prospect of becoming a governess, which is a fate too horrible for her to contemplate, and too horrible for a proud young woman like herself, who nonetheless learns that it may be her only way of earning a living. So she's been taught music at the level of social gatherings, but when she considers making it her profession, she finds that she has been badly taught, woefully undertrained. So being spoiled has two meanings here. One, you say, oh, you're spoiled. That seems to imply that there's something wrong with the character of the child. But spoiled also means here that something has spoiled her. And spoiled in this sense is to be cursed with an education that flatters its subject into believing in her superiority without making her competitive in the democratic marketplace where, as we see, foreigners are now beginning to demonstrate their true artistry and their very fine training. So this is something that we may also consider. We're not marking at every point how this book pertains in its relevance to the situation that people find themselves in today. But I would say here is really one mark of astonishing similarity where these same sources of dissatisfaction seem to me much more pronounced today. Everyone is educated to be an aristocrat in the sense that we're not trained to sustain that way of life and then expected to earn our living. When the training of aristocrats is no longer grounded in the concept of noblesse oblige, that is, that privilege obliges you to behave in a certain way, generously and wisely towards those who are less well endowed. So I think that Gwendolyn has been granted the privilege of quite an aristocratic education, that is to say, an education without training for any professional goal, without having been told what is expected of her, and without having been taught what it means to be worthy of that privilege. And then this book points us to another problem that runs even deeper than a mother's overindulgence or an education's inadequacy. At the very moment that Gwendolyn returns to what she calls her home, that is to say, Offendene, that home is associated by the text, by the narrator, with thinness and shallowness, as though farmers were trying to raise crops in a soil that was not rich enough to sustain them. And here is this paragraph that begins that chapter. Pity that Offendene was not the home of Miss Harless' childhood, or endeared to her by family memories. A human life, I think, should be well rooted in some spot of a native land, where it may get the love of tender kindship for the face of the earth, for the labors of men to go forth to, for the sounds and accents that haunt it, for whatever will give that early home a familiar, unmistakable difference amidst the future widening of knowledge. A spot where the definiteness of early memories may be inwrought with affection and kindly acquaintance with all neighbors, even to the dogs and donkeys, may spread not by sentimental effort and reflection, but, this is an amazing phrase, but as a sweet habit of the blood. At 5 years old, Mortals are not prepared to be citizens of the world, to be stimulated by abstract nouns, to soar above preference into impartiality. And that prejudice in favor of milk, with which we blindly begin, is a type of the way body and soul must get nourished, at least for a time. The best introduction to astronomy is to think of the nightly heavens as a little lot of stars belonging to one's own homestead. And then the next paragraph, but this blessed persistence in which affection can take root had been wanting in Gwendolyn's life. So Gwendolyn may be an Englishwoman, British by birth, but her father's early death and the mother's peripatetic life with a second husband means that she lacked this elemental sweet habit of the blood that extends from the earth below to the heavens above. So the narrator, speaking as first person singular, I, tells us that children ought to be raised, that they deserve to be raised with an attachment to place that cannot be acquired or lost, and the greater mobility that now exists in every sphere, geographic, economic, social, and matrimonial, means that children no longer grow up with the security that is implied by the phrases mother's milk or native soil. By place, I think the narrator here literally means place, attachment to homestead that also extends to the nation. The pity that Offendene was not Gwendolyn's childhood home, and that she had no other such childhood home to speak of, is meant to account for some absence in her of essential attachment, and perhaps for the ability to form any such attachment. Because this is, according to this text and to this very potent paragraph, this is not something that can be acquired through reading, through later education, and all the rest of it. This is not something abstract, as she calls it. This is just something that ought to be there. And so that the loyalty bred by nativism, right, this kind of nativism, may be put to rotten uses, as Eliot knew it was beginning to be in parts of Europe. We know what can happen with such an attachment. That does not lessen its worth. So the British problem in this book is not the excessive emphasis on blood and soil, Blut und Boden, as was becoming a political feature in Germany, but rather the problem is the erosion of familial and national rootedness that this book considers healthy for human development. And so thinking largely about Gwendolyn and the difficulties, obviously, of forming close attachments, I mean, this is something to consider. And then growing up without this binding attachment to home, Gwendolyn is likewise without any religious upbringing. Now, the Christianity of her uncle, the rector, is entirely pastoral, without any apparent spiritual content. He's a wonderfully practical, wonderfully great minister of his territory, but really a spiritual leader. He says of himself that this is not really his métier. And in the backstory that fills in what we know of Gwendolyn before she turns up at the gambling casino, we see her organizing a Christmas entertainment. This is a Christmas entertainment. So she cajoles and she bullies the players into acting and members of the audience into attending a performance of theatrical tableau chosen to show her off to greatest advantage. She and her cousin Rex consider doing scenes from Homer and Shakespeare, but no Christian motif. Now, it's during that performance that this boxed contraption suddenly springs open, revealing a skeletal figure of death. This triggers not only Gwendolyn's understandable fright, but genuine terror. The word terror is used. that might be expected in a person given to hysterics, but is mysterious in someone who is otherwise so commandeering. I think it's the variance between her power, including her powers of self-control, and her betrayal of this existential terror that alerts us to something missing. And I think that it is something like the missing religious component of her life. When Christmas is only an excuse for pagan theatrics, mortal dread pounces through another door. And so I do think that the juxtaposition of doing these Christmas theatricals with no religious motif in sight, and this absolute terror at the sight of death or something of this kind, some intimation of real mortality or threat, cosmic or, you know, totally real, penetrating, that there is a correlation between these two. So in sum, the elements that comprise Gwendolyn's personality and circumstance include absent fathering, overindulgent mothering, inappropriate education, lack of native attachment, and want of religious guidance or moral training. The book's impression is that religion and family stability were being eroded, with so far no better structures or cultural values to replace them. And the book's verdict on Gwendolyn and on the forces shaping her seemed to be pretty harsh. Harsh, but let me say again, harsh because of how much she is missing, but then over and over again, the book asks us to put ourselves sympathetically in her place and to try to understand them. When she finds out that she has to be a governess and that this is the fate that that faces her, she says, she had a world nausea upon her and so saw no reason all through her life why she should wish to live. No religious view of trouble helped her. Her troubles had, in her opinion, all been caused by other people's disagreeable or wicked conduct. And there was really nothing pleasant to be counted on in the world. That was her feeling. Everything else she had heard said about trouble was mere phrase making, not attractive enough for her to have caught it up and repeated it. As to the sweetness of labor and fulfilled claims, the interest of inward and outward activity, the impersonal delights of life as a perpetual discovery, the dues of courage, fortitude, industry, which is mere baseness not to pay toward the common burden, the supreme worth of the teacher's vocation, these, even if they had been eloquently preached to her, could have been no more than faintly apprehended doctrines. The fact which wrought upon her was her invariable observation that for a lady to become a governess, to take a situation, was to descend in life and to be treated at best with a compassionate patronage. And poor Gwendolyn had never dissociated happiness from personal preeminence and éclat. That where these threatened to forsake her, she should take life to be hardly worth the having, cannot make her so unlike the rest of us, men or women, that we should cast her out of our compassion, our moments of temptation to a mean opinion of things in general, being usually dependent on some susceptibility about ourselves and some dullness to subjects which everyone else would consider more important. And listen to this. Surely a young creature is pitiable who has the labyrinth of life before her and no clue, to whom distrust in herself and her good fortune has come as a sudden shock, like a rent across the path that she was treading carelessly. Now this phrase again, the labyrinth of life before her and no clue how to navigate the labyrinth. So we should feel some sympathy for her. But wait a minute, you say, this is really not all of it. These givens are only the start of the story because Gwendolyn may be spoiled and selfish and too easily satisfied with herself, but she is also exceptional and open to correction. So let's look at the side of her a little bit that has Miss Mary, the meek but observant governess, saying, Gwendolyn will not rest without having the world at her feet. "I am determined to be happy," she announces with conviction. She does not intend to compromise. She will not be dull or middling. She intends to be remarkable. When her mother says that she should not expect her cousin Anna to be her equal, she tosses her head and says, "I don't want her to be equal." She wants to excel, to lead. Interestingly, she wants to lead. Daniel wants to lead. Difference? Similarity. But it's for us to account for what is so different in her case from what exists in his case. She is not intimidated by persons of higher wealth or status. She wins the archery contest up to a point. She becomes the belle of the ball. And her uncle, the rector, may assume that she will use her magnificence to secure herself an advantageous marriage. But the novel sets us straight on page 31. But let no one suppose that she also contemplated a brilliant marriage as the direct end of her witching the world with her grace on horseback or with any other accomplishment. That she was to be married sometime or other, she would have felt obliged to admit, and that her marriage would not be of a middling kind, such as most girls were contented with, she felt quietly, argumentatively sure. But her thoughts never dwelt on marriage as the fulfillment of her ambition. Gwendolyn is the new woman, without inhibitions about wanting to have it all. At one point, when she appears to soften, the narrator assures us, "Oh, there was more show of fire and will in her than ever, but there was more calculation in it," right? Meaning that she is clever enough to use diplomacy in achieving her end. So I think all these are quite admirable qualities in their own way, right, that speak for her. So the adults around her expect the institution of marriage to serve social stability, which would allow an exceptional girl like her to marry up. In this case, such a girl might be expected to invest her feminine capital in securing for herself and her family the status that they have lost. Her mother is torn. She wants for her daughter to have both the stability in marriage and true affection for her husband. But Gwendolyn, who likes riding, does not want to be stabled or ridden for that matter. Affection is altogether less important to her than mastery and freedom. So until the point of her marriage, the novel might have turned on this conventional conflict that we spoke of between society and the individual, between her uncle and her mother representing the family that wants and needs for Gwendolyn to marry someone who can bring them financial and social security, and on the other hand, the rebellious daughter who intends to follow her heart's desire. Instead, as someone remarked, that storyline is relegated to the subplot of Catherine Arrowpoint and her teacher, Herr Klesmer. And it is resolved very quickly, suggesting that the traditional taboos and expectations regarding unsuitable alliances are no longer as durable or important as they seemed. So unlike Catherine, Gwendolyn is not looking for love, and neither is she looking to defy society. Her ambition is to rise, to be magnificent without the need for love. The whole question of sexuality and affection is complicated by her coldness to men that has some readers wondering whether she might have been abused by her stepfather. This has been a theory that was thrown out to account for this. Now, I don't think there's any real allusion to such possibilities in the book, and there are plenty of women who seem frigid until they thaw. Gwendolyn seems to be one of these, perhaps in reaction to her mother's second marriage, and perhaps as an innate quality of her being. Thawing may have been for her just a matter of time, but there was no time. The sudden poverty that befalls the family makes advantageous marriage the logical way out of the practical predicament of poverty. Her predicament is more like that of the male in fiction, who has to calculate his strategy of social advancement. marrying Grandcourt is the reasonable calculation of the new woman who wants the freedom to control her life. So it seems that on that level, unless we are romantics, there doesn't seem to be anything totally wrong with it. Gwendolyn's conflict does not involve love, but it does involve something. It involves conscience, right? Along with the strength of her will, she has a lively conscience that is awakened when she is confronted by Lydia Glasher with the two children in tow, one of them a little boy that should be Grandcourt's rightful heir. This ambush in the forest marks the end of Gwendolyn's innocence. The question of marriage is no longer about whether she wants to surrender part of her freedom or about whether she's ready to put up with being touched. It involves gaining what she needs by wronging someone else. It means knowingly marrying a man who has wronged another and then being implicated in that transgression by colluding with him in ignoring the earlier affair. We note that neither Grandcourt nor Gwendolyn commits any crime. No one in the book except Lapidoth in the final pages commits a criminal offense. The sins of Grandcourt and the collusion of Gwendolyn are behavior that society ignores. It's prepared to accept it, right? Lydia Glasher, who committed adultery, could not have taken either Grandcourt or Gwendolyn to court, which is why she terrorizes her rival in secret. So what is the problem? If Gwendolyn were truly a match for Grandcourt, she would have handled Lydia as coolly as he does when he threatens to withdraw his support. Gwendolyn could have rationalized her decision to marry Grandcourt by blaming Lydia for having committed adultery in the first place. We know even worse of Lydia. In running off with another man, she deserted her child. But Gwendolyn, in her bid for power, is not a match for Grandcourt. She is not the unsexed Lady Macbeth. She aspires to be a good person. The first time after that encounter with Lydia Glasher, when she sees the person who does know the difference between right and wrong, namely that gentleman who looks at her disapprovingly when she is gambling, she adopts him as her kind of moral guide and guardian. She wants him to be her better nature. In designating Deronda as a kind of father confessor, she is not merely conducting a flirtation, although there is some of that certainly. She genuinely hopes that he can save her, that he can extricate her from the harm that she may do and can do to others and herself. Another woman might have camouflaged her misery by growing even a harder shell, or stifled her conscience to become more like her husband. Now, Gwendolyn certainly develops a harder shell, and she does not want the world to suspect what is going on inside her, but at the same time, she begins to look for moral reinstatement. So Gwendolyn is in part a casualty of her situation, but you see that she is neither society's victim nor a feminist heroine, and this is very far from a conventional feminist tract. No one has driven her to the gambling table where we first encounter her. No one forces her to keep losing instead of cutting her losses. No one forces her into marriage or determines the way she handles that marriage. The reasons for her misery and the misery that she comes to experience are as gnarled as the roots of any tree. The book tells us that Gwendolyn started out with a naive delight in her fortunate self, which any but the harshest saintliness will have some indulgence for in a girl who had every day seen a pleasant reflection of that self in her friend's flattery as well as in the looking glass. So again, asking, we would have to be the harshest saints. Unless we pretend to that harshless saintliness, we are asked to have indulgence for this girl, and our indulgence grows with her guilt, not out of pity, but with respect for how badly she tries to be better than she was brought up to be. The unfolding of a story that hinges on moral choices doesn't mean looking for someone or something to blame in either the victim or the victimizer. And I think that is what we are being warned against. Let's not make an ideology out of this, right? Let's not look for an answer that is going to be a social message that we are then going to proclaim on that basis. What it means is knowing that without a strict code of behavior and without firm sources of authority, it is hard to know how to distinguish good from evil, let alone how to live virtuously. We're not invited to judge Gwendolyn, but to comprehend her from the inside as she appears to herself and to others. Things have grown more complicated for the new woman who must learn to take greater moral responsibility, but without having been given really the tools that most people are given when they are expected to become moral human beings. Without minimizing the social constraints that handicap women like Lydia and Gwendolyn, and without hiding the abuses that they may be subject to at the hands of men who exert control over them, this book sees in Gwendolyn every aspect of that new woman whose new problems derive from the very conditions that offer her new freedom, the freedom that she now has the power to abuse. And others have equal new freedoms, which also allow them to have greater power over her. So now, interestingly, George Eliot was a model and a spokeswoman for women's rights. She supported the cause of women's education. She was the best example why a woman's mind should be assumed to be at least as good as a man's. She had liberated herself from family expectations and social conventions. At the age of 22, she refused to attend church and initiated what she called, this is her term, a holy war with her traditional respectable family that brought about a fatal rupture with her beloved brother. He did not make it up with her until the end of her life. She stayed home to take care of her father while making it clear that she was no longer a Christian in belief. And this was the bargain that they struck. She would go to church, but everybody would know that she was no longer a Christian in belief, right? Interesting. So this is a woman who then began to publish under a man's name, but not in order to hide from the public. That was her way of ensuring that her work would be taken seriously, not relegated to the category of women's writing. But once the quality of her work was recognized, she was happy to be known as the female author of her books. When she loved an already married man who could not divorce his wife, she lived with him and, as I said, insisted on being called Mrs. George Henry Lewes. And though she never had children of her own, she cared for and supervised as well as she could the children of the man she called her husband. She proved her independence and her equal right to independence. Yet, ideological feminists are very disappointed to learn that when John Stuart Mill took up the subject of women's suffrage, George Eliot opposed an amendment that would have granted women the right to vote. I don't think that she was at all ambivalent about women's wisdom. I think she was concerned that if everyone became concerned in the same way about power, if the personal became political for women as it was for men, the family and the nation would suffer. And women all the more so. So Gwendolyn is the repository of those concerns. A bold and brilliant woman should not be thwarted, but the assertion of rights and the claims to freedom dare not be her exclusive goals. Gwendolyn's concentration on her own advancement distorts her personality and exposes her to dangers that she is not equipped to handle. The serial collapse of family and tradition and national cohesion, sometimes for good reasons and necessary reasons, is not to be celebrated without considering that something worse may arise to replace it. Not something better, but something worse. So the satisfying thing about the fiction of Jane Austen in the first decades of the 19th century is that similarly bold and independent and marvelous young women of her novels hold out for true affection, and they manage to find it through traditional marriages. As one critic very astutely observed, the characters of Jane Austen essentially marry substitute fathers, and what secures happiness and tradition any better than that? The half century that separated Jane Austen from George Eliot greatly changed the political and social and cultural landscape of England, and George Eliot was intellectually keen enough to see the complications that these changes had brought about. Insouciant women and complacent British society are not going to meet the new challenges. And I think that Gwendolyn Harleth really presents for us the very complicated, the irreducible complexities of the situation in which a person like herself, in the time that she is growing up, is exposed to. Everybody sees such potential. After all, there is this very talented girl, this extraordinary girl who thinks of herself as extraordinary. She should have an extraordinary life. And there is this aristocrat who is looking for a wife. She doesn't have money. He does. He has the wherewithal. Isn't this a perfect union of sorts? So it is a marriage of ultimate convenience in terms of the British class system of the time and British expectations. And it is a horror story because Grandcourt is an aristocrat without anything to do. He is an aristocrat whose function in society is no longer operative. She, in a sense, is not so dissimilar from that. She has been educated well. She has been trained well. But for what? She has been given no professional guidance. She has not been taught morally how to act in society, what is demanded of her, what is expected of her in terms of her responsibility. So here are these two people yoked together in what seems to be a perfectly socially convenient arrangement, and one exercises his power over the other, who wanted to exercise her charming power over him, but of course is unable to do so because his power is ultimately ultimate. So this is really a marriage made in hell, and it does indeed end in a kind of hell. Somehow George Eliot's personal struggle with these issues had also led her to connect in some way the concerns of women with the concerns of Jews, both fighting ingrained prejudice, both demanding greater freedom, yet uncertain about the ultimate aim of self-liberation. Would women and Jews try to free themselves from their essential nature in a way that will doom them to misery? Or could they emancipate themselves and win their independence in a way that could release their best potential? So George Eliot's novel accords equal attention to womanhood and to the Jews as two issues that strongly determine the kind of country that England is to be. And these issues become interdependent. Gwendolyn's unusual relationship with Deronda demonstrates what the British need from the Jews in their kind of wisdom going forward, and what the Jews need from Britain as it opens up and expands. In a kind of summation, I think what I see coming into dramatic focus through Gwendolyn is this idea of this amazing woman. Yes, I mean, we see her flaws, her selfishness, and all the rest of it, but we also see at the very beginning, hey, isn't this what one aspired to? You know, just I do it myself. I'm great. I'm wonderful. I am woman. I mean, all these phrases that one learns, right? And now more and more so. But at a very early point of the emergence of this kind of freedom, George Eliot really begins to point out for us its enormous complexity, both for the person herself and for everyone else who surrounds her, for the entire society that surrounds her. And to some extent, this will relate to our idea of the nation, because certainly at that point, the idea of the nation is firmly connected with motherhood. And you see that in Emma Lazarus's sonnet at the foot of the Statue of Liberty, Mother of Exiles, right? It's the mother image. It's Mother Rachel who is supposed to welcome back all the sons and daughters who come back to the land of Israel after their exile. So this implicit connection between womanhood and national identity is there really as the undercurrent in all of this as well. Going forward, one of the real things to think about is what makes Gwendolyn into the kind of person that she is, and who is she going to become? What will become of her? Will she be able to realize her potential or not? Is that her fault? Does that have to do with her personality, or is it because of the society that has contributed to her upbringing in a certain way? Is she more endowed with talent, or is she more missing in things that she should have been given but is without? So those are some of the things that we think about when we think about her. The other thing that we're now forced to think about is what happens when a girl like that, who is not evil at all, she is naive, she doesn't know very much about the world. What happens when she comes up against real evil? What happens to her then? Will she be destroyed? And why doesn't she know? Why doesn't she have any idea as to how to deal with these things? Will the book supply the education that she is getting through it? In other words, when we see the education of Gwendolyn Harleth, is that some way that we should now appreciate that society should be providing that education for girls like her?
For additional information about the Tikva Fund, please visit tikvafund.org.